Blog Talk Radio.
Blog
Talk Radio.
Brothers and sisters, welcome to True School Show, brought to you by Black Hawk Radio.
Yo, Blake, man, you see how they trying to put you down, son? They want to put you up in the papers, man. And they want to scandalize your name.
Yeah.
Yeah, we see what's going on, man. The community's behind you. Yo, man, they don't know what you did to turn that school around. Yo, man, you got to let these people know who you are, man. You made 109 shine, man. Talk to these people, man. Tell them who you are, man.
Hey, it's the 109 man. Time is shining, I'm still shining. I'm the guy who's changed the school around. Still there are those who want to put me down. You see, I bought the uniform to the school and every day it's worn. Teachers teaching at a high degree, using data, and that's because of me. Children smiling on their face, there's glee. 109 is where they want to be. I'm a leader, hey man, it's crazy. Never thought in my life that one day I'd be in charge of so many young minds, counting on me almost all the time. But my father told me when I was young, one day you're gonna be a leader, son. So I step to the plate, man, even though the haters, man, keep on hating. I'm a leader, not because I wanna rule. I'm a leader because I changed the school.
I'm a leader. Yo, Blake, man, tell about the process, man. Tell about the pain,
I've been through the process, I felt the pain. Now I got something to say, so let me explain. Hypocrite and slick, but that's the game. Disrespect my character, defame my name. So one love, for Martin and Garvey. Just like you see, they want to starve me. Isolation like robust sun, but in the end, we'll see who wins. And to some elected officials, talk hard but soft like tissue. Never there to address the issue. And when it comes to the fight, hey man, we miss you. Nope, I'm not trying to diss you, but look in the mirror and you'll see that it's true. Now, I won't call your name out, but if it hits you, it fits you, it's you, no doubt. See, our children are dying, going to jail while their mamas are crying. In upstate jails, they make more predicted by third grade reading scores.
I'm a leader. Crazy, man.
This week's topic and this week's show. And I like to start off by saying first that when you see people doing innovative things in the community, we need to highlight them, we need to celebrate them, and we need to get their life's work out there so that the community can know who they are, what they're doing, and how they're making a difference. I'm a firm believer that when we share information and we share examples, then as a community, we all grow together. I want to remind you that Black Hole Radio and the True School Show, we are about analyzing issues in our inner city schools that affect our children. We are focused on the problems that plague urban education. But we don't want to become great over-analyzers of problems without looking for solutions. So this is a solution-based show. And in that spirit, we bring on people who have developed models. We bring on people who are role models, and we bring on people who are doing innovative things to connect with our young people. If you're interested in my work and what I do, then you can go to www.shungoblake.com and go to the True SK Consultant page, and you can reach me there, and I'll be more than happy to come talk to your group, do consultant work around urban education, or just share information that might be helpful to the different things that you're facing or you're dealing with. Also, you can like me on Facebook, and that's Facebook.com/ShungoBlake, or follow me on Twitter at ShungoBlake. Now, this week, we are speaking with a very innovative young lady by the name of Thea Monet. She's an educator, she's a clinical therapist, and she's a spoken word artist, and we hope before the show is over, we're going to hear some of her pieces, and it will inspire the next generation of artists to step up and do things that bring forth empowerment, enlightenment, and knowledge. But we're going to talk to her about her work as a family therapist and how she uses elements of spoken word and hip-hop to reach young people. Now, I'd like to give you some information about Miss Monet. From filming two episodes of HBO Deaf Poetry Gym in New York to the Poetry Lounge in Los Angeles and countless colleges and universities in between, Thea Monet takes her vision to any audience open to listen and share with her. She has graced television with BET, The Way We Do It, and Lyric Cafe and radio stations in Los Angeles such as 102.3 KJLH, 92.3 The Beat, and 90.7 KPKF. In addition, she is an MC who ignites stages with live music and relevant lyrics, keyword, relevant lyrics, and has opened for artists such as Kenny Lattimore, Lara Hathaway on legendary stages such as the Ford Amphitheater in Hollywood, California, and recently she performed at the NAACP's 102nd National Convention in Los Angeles, California, and featured on TV1's Versus and Flows Season 1. Recently, she was honored to perform at Senator Curran Price Jr.'s annual Sheroes Award Ceremony, celebrating the amazing contribution of women in Los Angeles. Thea's solo poetry album titled Intuition is an eclectic collection of spoken words that speak to her literary abilities and emotional range, is currently available on iTunes, and she is currently editing her first book of poetry and other writings. Offstage, Thea Monet spends her time working with at-risk families as a marriage and family therapist in Los Angeles, California. She has facilitated workshops for Brave New Voices, an organization for poets ages 12 to 17, Sex and Sisterhood, a workshop co-presented with HBO's deaf poet Mada Day Vale, I hope I'm saying that right, focused on relationship building between women and self and women and the mic, a workshop facilitated at the annual Ink Slam Festival in Los Angeles, focused on empowering women to embrace their feminine strengths and incorporate them into poetry performance. Currently, she is also contributed to Say Word LA, a nonprofit organization providing spoken word curriculum at Los Angeles-based schools. And we're going to get into that. That's very interesting. And she sits on the board of directors for Manhood Camp, a non nonprofit that facilitates life work skills for at-risk teen boys. Throughout the years, she's facilitated women's self-awareness groups, teen relationship support groups, hip-hop poetry workshops for children ages 9 to 18, and combines her love for poetry and therapy by speaking at universities and colleges such as Pepperdine University on the effectiveness of writing as a therapeutic intervention. Currently, she has been conducting soul sessions and interactive exchange such as using spoken word and therapeutic insight to engage with students nationwide. Thea Monet, Marriage of Therapy and Performance creates a dynamic that provides audiences with more than entertainment. She offers enlightenment. Don't just take our word for it. Check it out yourself. And so with that being said, I want to introduce our audience to Ms. Thea Monet. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you for reading all of that for me.
Listen, I think it's important that people know what you're doing and what you're about. And you have really been involved in so many things. And I love the way that you've bridged poetry and artistry and expression with dealing with some of the real, I would say, academic and social issues that face many of our young people in our communities. I mean, I think it's a perfect marriage. And when I was speaking to you off air, we talked about how me and you share a commonality in reference to how we've used hip-hop to motivate young people.
Yeah, definitely. I think you have to use whatever works. I think that's kind of been my MO, you know, in working with families and working with children and working with couples, is like you don't bring your approach to them. You find out what they need, and then you build an approach around what they need. And so you use whatever's available to you. Hip-hop and spoken word just happen to be still something that can be tailored towards an individual's needs. And so that's why they're perfect to use with all kinds of young people, because they, and actually spoken word actually is more popular with, I'm finding, adults that I work with too, who are working on expressing themselves, because it can be tailored to what they want, to what they need, and how, and their comfort level.
Exactly. And I tell you, you know, one of the ultimate goals of writing, any form of writing, really is to develop voice.
Yes.
You know, it's a vehicle that allows you to have voice about world issues, personal issues, community issues. But it allows, one of the things that I've always focused on when dealing with the writer's workshop and with young people is that this is an opportunity for you to develop your craft so that you can have a voice in a number of issues, you know, whether it's telling your own personal story or whether it's reflecting the history of our people or whether it's commenting or addressing something that you see as an injustice. Writing creates that opportunity, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of times people, when they email me or they talk to me and they're like, you know, I really want you to read my writing. I really want you to let me know what you think. You know, I give them the disclaimer that I don't critique writing. You know, what I can give you feedback on is how you made me feel and what you can do differently so that I can feel more of what you're trying to tell me, or that I could be more clear about what you're trying to tell me. So my approach is usually, you know, I'm not here to teach you how to write or tell you how to write, but what I am here to do is to remove any obstacles between what you want to say, between your voice and the ear that you want your message to get to. I can do that for you. But your writing is your own. You know, how you put words together, what words you choose to use. I will challenge people to read more so that they can expand their vocabulary and think about all the flavors. I always say, like, when you first start writing, it's like you have your primary colors when you first start painting. You know, you got your green, your white, black, red, blue, you know, and then eventually you start using pinks and purples and, you know, you start dabbling into different shades of green because your palette is growing. And it's the same thing with writing. The more you do it, the more colors you have to paint the picture with. But, you know, my big thing is, what do you want me to leave with? And here's how you can do that clear. One of the biggest things, the biggest tips I always give people is, don't you get more, I get more from you when you write in the first person. So even if you're talking about history or society, if you start me off with a personal narrative, you got me. You got me. I'm gonna buy into the bigger picture because you started off with something that's connected to you. And that's how all these things are in life. You know, we look at education and we look at all these big social systems, they start off with the smaller units, each individual child in each individual home with each individual family. That leads to a collection of students at a school, that leads to a school district. You see what I'm saying? And
yes.
So the micro and the macro are always connected. It's just about helping people to see how they're connected. And that's why that writing, those individual voices being clear, are so important to the big picture.
I couldn't say it better. I want to just say to the audience, what educational issues are important to you? Please let us know. And you can do that by emailing me at shungo@blackholeradio.com. We want to use this as a forum and a means for you to get the educational issues that are important to you out there and addressed. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to really get into some deeper conversations with our guest, Thea Monet, about, you know, working with young people, dealing with families, and the impact that, not only use the term dysfunctional, but issues within the family, how that may impact a child's education. These are the kind of things that we're going to talk to her about. We're going to also get into her poetry and hopefully hear her give us a spoken word piece. So we'll be right back after this commercial break. Okay, I don't know if we're having technical difficulties, so I will table that commercial break for a little bit down the line, and we will get right into the conversation.
No, I'm with you, brother. No, I agree.
You don't know what you're talking about. I went 15 years here in America to hear good radio, like Black Hole Radio. I wait a long time, and you just come up now? Why you wait so long? I'm going to listen to every one of your shows. I love Black Hole Radio, but I don't like you.
Okay, boss. I got him right here.
Maxie, let the gentleman have a seat right here.
Sure thing, boss. You heard the man. Have a seat.
Now, thank yous for joining me. I would like to make yous an offer that you should not refuse. Listen to Black Hole Radio. It's good for yous.
Celebrity Voices Impersonated.
I got angry, so I thought I could just leave this place. I thought I could just mentally exist somewhere else without the pressures of daily life. So I built a rocket ship, not only in my mind, but a physical rocket ship to take me away from this place. A place in space, some place that I could be and be not. I flew and I went up out of the atmosphere, past the known universe, until I came to a point in space where there was my black hole. Listen to Black Hole Radio, the irresistible force in the universe. Peace.
Now returns us back to True School with your host, Shango Blake.
brothers and sisters, I want to remind you that to call us, you can call 323-927-2913. Press the number one key on your keypad if you have any questions or comments. We are here talking to Thea Monet, spoken word artist, family therapist, educator, activist. I mean, just an overall Renaissance woman, if I might say. And Thea, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. Now, how long have you been practicing? A practicing licensed therapist.
I'm going up for my license exam this year, actually. But I've been practicing marriage family therapy since 2009.
Mm.
I started off working in 2005 with an organization called Children's Law Center, which advocates for foster youth, and doing social work investigation for the attorneys. But the problems that we were seeing were more pervasive, and I really got interested in wanting to find out what was going on in their families. So I went back to school and got my degree to do marriage family therapy, and been, you know, basically engulfed in that ever since.
Wow. And what are the major family issues that you deal with as a counselor, as a therapist?
You know, it really varies. I couldn't say by diagnosis because it changes, but I think the number one things that people struggle with are communication, 100%. Mm-hmm. When there's no communication, the next thing to go is empathy and compassion. When you don't understand where someone's coming from, you lose the ability to meet their needs and to even see that they need something. It kind of becomes everybody for themselves in a family, you know, and everybody sort of goes to their own corner to cope in their own way as opposed to reaching towards each other. So communication is really, really, really huge. And then unresolved generational issues is another big one. So parents with unresolved issues have difficulty, one, acknowledging their child's issues and the parents' relationship to those issues and the parents' responsibility for some of those issues. But they also have a hard time dealing with it because it brings up their own issues, their own unresolved issues that they may not want to deal with. And today's kids are much more, they explore more. They're a lot more aware, and they don't fake it. You know, they don't fake when something's not feeling right, when something doesn't seem genuine, when there's a problem. You know, we call these the identified patients, the kids who act out, because while everybody else is pretending everything is all good, they're going to be the ones that say, no, there's a problem over here. You know, they're going to be the ones that sell the family out and bring your attention to the fact that there's some sickness here. Everybody else may just play along. But today's kids are a lot less likely to play along. They're going to speak out, in whether it's through poor behavior or whether it's through failing grades or whether it's through being withdrawn or joining gangs. They're going to find a way to bring attention to the family because the family needs some sort of healing. Mm-hmm. And often they get, instead of it being recognized that way, what happens is they get labeled the black sheep of the family, or the family's more comfortable saying, if this person wasn't here, we would be all right. You know, so I think those are some of the bigger issues. Without going into a diagnosis, those are some of the bigger issues we face, is, you know, communication, poor coping skills, and this generational unresolved trauma and issues.
Now, how do you deal with, you know, because one thing that you said was that, you know, they'll cry out, or they'll say, no, something's not right, and it may manifest itself in terms of, like you said, leaning towards gangs or problems in school, things of that nature. How do you help, let's say, a teacher in a classroom who has maybe 33 to 36 students in their class, and they're dealing with multiple personalities, and of course, now they're dealing with the group dynamics of these young people interacting with each other, and there may be issues of anger that come out different ways. There may be conflicts, you know. And what would be your advice to that teacher in that classroom working with those group of young people? Before you answer that, the reason I'm even raising it is that, you know, I often hear teachers say, well, it's not my job to deal with this. My job is just to teach them, teach the class. And there's not a lot of empathy in the way of understanding where I believe these young people are coming from. So how do we bridge that gap since they do have that captive audience?
Well, number one, I would say it's extremely challenging. I know in California right now, and Los Angeles, recently a funding source known as AB 3632 was ended last year. And the program I work with in home therapy that I work with felt the brunt, because once that program ended, that program was used to assist with mental health services identified by schools.
Mm-hmm.
So once that ended, these kids were forced back into sort of intensive community health resources. But we had never seen kids. It was like one of the toughest years for our program, because these are kids that normally go to a sort of a residential placement that has a school attached to it, you know, so that they can continue their education while getting their needs met in a therapeutic setting. So it's a huge challenge, especially with budget issues, for a teacher. Not to mention that they're having to teach to a test. Add that on to it. To deal with. Add that to the fact that a lot of these children are displaced from home to home, and so there's a lot of attachment issues, there's a lot of abandonment issues. They all have needs. And if they don't get those needs met at home, what teachers have to realize is the job that you signed up for is to be the adult in this person's life for 8 hours a day. And that is the second most contact they're going to have other than their parent. It's a big job. It's kind of like for adults, we have to say, look, if I'm going to commit to a job 8 hours a day, it should be something I like, you know, because I'm going to spend almost more time at this job sometimes than I am with my family. And so teachers have to recognize that that's the type of job they've taken on, and the support that they need is not always available, but the need is always going to be there, you know. So one of the things I do when I work with teachers is I call my work with schools like PR work, because by the time the kid gets to me, this is the bad kid, definitely, and they know his or her name in the office as soon as you walk in the door. And, you know, all the reinforcement has been most likely, in most cases with schools, negative. So it's been, okay, he has this behavior or she has this behavior, so this is the consequence, which makes sense depending on the child. If that's a child who gets a lot of negative reinforcement at home, all you're doing is reinforcing what they already think about themselves based on what's happening at home. What's kind of counterintuitive to a lot of teachers is to use positive reinforcement, is to use praise. So every little thing
absolutely.
This kid does, you praise it. I don't care if he sits at his desk for 10 minutes without bothering anybody. You make him, you say, hey, I noticed that you sat there and paid attention for 10 minutes. That was really great. I know that was really hard for you, but I really appreciate that you did that. And when he does 15 minutes, and then you say it again, you stay on it. You know, you point out the positives, because I always say kids need a win, and you can't control what kind of home they come from, but you can give them a win at school. You can give them a W and make them feel successful somewhere. So I'll tell them, give the kid a responsibility. They'll say, you know, well, I don't want to do that because he's going to just give her a responsibility. Let her be in charge of the line. Let her be in charge of cleaning erasers. And that little task, that kid will feel a little bit of pride and accomplishment, and you will see it grow. I don't think teachers should get into the mental health component of it, because they really don't know. They'll be opening Pandora's box, but they should focus on how to make that kid feel successful, even if it's a little bitty dose of success in their school environment. And there's ways to do that through positive reinforcement.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly. I had a guest on 2 weeks ago, gentleman, he's a hip-hop artist. His name is Mo Slinger. And we were talking about, he's now a college professor, but he grew up and it was, you know, considered, you know, all the things that you would think in terms of an at-risk young person. Spent some time incarcerated, and it wasn't until he came out of the criminal justice system and went into college, he said, was the very first time that he was, because I think he got his diploma or GED and incarcerated. But when he came out and enrolled in college, it was the first time that he got positive reinforcement for his writing. And it impacted him so that he continued, and now he's a professor, and he deals with mentoring and tutoring adults who come back to school who are having difficulty in writing. So I wholeheartedly agree with you when you say that there's positive reinforcement. You know what? It reminds me of something that I did one time as an assistant principal. I had a group of students. I mean, these students were
shame.
When they hit the school, you saw them coming.
Many
of them were very, very. You know the group that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But they were very
yeah.
intelligent, very bright.
Yeah.
And I was trying to connect and reach them, and so I promised them. I said, "Listen, if you guys can stay out of trouble for a certain period of time and make it to all your classes, we'll give you a talent show and we'll allow you to express your creativity, what have you." And I got by them. But the funny thing was, when it came to the time for the talent show, all the teachers were saying, "Well, you know, these like you said, they were saying, you know, these kids are the kids who are always going to be problematic," and they kept on reinforcing the negative. And one of the things that the teacher said was, "Last time we had an event, you know, they were smoking marijuana and they were doing this and they were doing that and they were sneaking people into the school and what have you." And so what I decided to do was take the I call them the young soldiers. And I trained them and said, "Hey, you guys are going to be my other security. You're going to make sure no one sneaks in. You're going to make sure that no one brings any control stuff. You're going to do this. You're going to do that." And when I say that these young men accepted the challenge and did it with
trusted
such,
them.
And had
somebody
pride, but you know what the funny part was? The funny part was they were the ones who would have bought the drugs. Actually, by doing that, I rechanneled their energy, and they didn't even think about doing that because now instead of being outside the process, they were a part of the process.
Absolutely, and they were trusted. They were trusted with something when you trust somebody with something, that teaches them how to value something. You know that this is valuable, that this means something to me, because we also are up against the age where, you know, commercialism is so high that a lot of kids don't value things. You know, the way that we think they do. You know, we think that, oh, the toys and this and the gadgets and this, they don't really value it the way that we think they do. I mean, when you see a kid acting out like that, that's intelligent, 9 out of 10, this is a kid that when I sit down and talk to them about what substances they're using and why, they'll be like, I don't know. I just do it. They're bored. There's no activity. They're not in something. Nobody's invested in them. Parenting takes energy. Teaching takes energy, and these are things that if you're going to do, you need to be an energetic person because these kids are not easily entertained. They're going to ask the challenging questions. They're going to want to try new things. They're going to want to test boundaries, and you have to be up to the challenge. And so I think just you giving them that responsibility said, somebody trusts me enough to put me in charge of something, and so I'm going to rise to the occasion.
And there's a thing called TESA. It stands for Teacher Expectation Student Achievement. And the conventional thinking is that young people will always rise to the level of expectation that you put on them. So if your expectation is low, then they'll rise to that low level.
Right.
But if you raise the bar, then in raising the bar, you also raise the achievement. Now, I have a question for you. You had said earlier that, and it's such a key word. You said, "Listen, you know, by the time the young people come to me, I'm sort of like a public relations person because now they've already been labeled as a bad child."
Yeah.
And I want to take that little microcosm as you earlier described and take it to the macrocosm. And that is, I really believe that, and you can weigh in on this, that administrators and policymakers don't really understand the key role that counselors, social workers, and school psychologists play in a school. And the reason I say that is because a lot of times when it comes to funding and budget cuts and they make these decisions, the first place where they cut is in the area of mental health.
What can
counselors, psychologists, social workers do as a collective group to, you know, be better PR people and get the word out to those who are policymakers about the critical importance of mental health services in public education?
Well, I think when we look at that, we have to also look at demographics, because certain cultures value mental health more than others, and certain cultures are more afraid of mental health than others. So, with Black and Brown culture, it's still more of a stigma attached to the idea of receiving mental health services. So clearly, if you have a school in those areas, parents may not outcry the way they would in another culture's area if those services are cut. I don't know if it's necessarily, it could be a combination of where they place the value of these services, because a lot of what these cultures have been through has been traumatic, but it's also been normalized. So they feel like, I'm doing fine. You know, we're doing fine. Like, it's funny when you have therapists come in from other cultures to work with inner city kids, because one of the main things they always want to write down is post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Now, I see that, but the problem is it's a part of their daily lifestyle, so they don't see it as post-traumatic stress. So when you try to set up goals for a family, the goals have to be something that they're in agreement with, that they view as a problem. If this child is used to gangs being on every corner and the homie getting killed over here, you have to find a way to treat that through their lens, through the lens of what they see as normal. So how that plays out at the school is very similar. These teachers and the staff and the administrators in those areas are also very used to certain things. I'll give you a perfect example. There's a case where, say you have a kid who the parent has requested an individual education plan several times. But this is a school that's in the area where there's a lot of housing projects. So they assume that this parent, like most parents in the area, do not know their rights as parents, that these are parents that just feed, clothe, and send their kids to school and just pray they come home safely so that they're not going to make a big fuss over whether or not their child gets what they need. And so the parents' rights are violated on many occasions because the school's assumption is this is a bad kid. You know, he doesn't need any special education plan. And, you know, if we bring in therapists and all that, they're just going to make us do a bunch of stuff that's not going to work on this kid anyway, you know. And I think that's sometimes the idea. We get a lot of that from probation as well, you know. Oh, what you going to do, hug the kid to death, you know. The reality is, this is the truth that people really don't understand about mental health.
It takes
somebody with courage to go to therapy, because you have to be willing to face some of the darkest parts of yourself and your family and want change and want joy and peace in your life so much that you're willing to face some of your deepest and darkest fears. It's not for punks. It is not for the faint of heart. The faint of heart avoid therapy because they don't want to deal with it. They want to cover it over. They're scared to see what's underneath there. But the brave will go into that session week after week and just reveal more and more of what's underneath there until they start to come up for air. And then they're starting to be able to show themselves. That is the misconception about mental health, that it's, you know, soft, or you're weak if you do it, or what are you whining about, toughen up. It takes so much more to go inside yourself and do your own emotional autopsy with a stranger than it does to go home and medicate it with weed or alcohol, or to walk down the block in a, you know, big jacket and, you know, a mad face. It takes a lot of courage. And that's what I think even socially people don't realize. They don't realize that about mental health. They think that it's a way of making excuses for people to do the things that they do. And it's not that. It's a way of understanding what leads people to do the things that they do and make the choices that they make.
Wow. I mean, that's right. You're right. I like the way that you're describing it in terms of, you know, really it takes heart, you know, to be able to go in and expose yourself in that manner. And you're right. That is a scary thing. And I know within our community, there's still a phobia when it comes to someone dealing with mental health. I mean, you know, guys, we'd rather go to the bar, to the barbershop. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
If women go to the stylist, but I know that's still an issue. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I think needs to happen is that I think for those who are in decision-making, you know, the people who control the purse, there needs to be a more proactive reaching out to those people who decide what programs are going to get cut and really look at the critical role that counseling plays. And when you said earlier that, you know, people view it as, what are you going to do, give them a hug? You know, I don't think that we as mental health professionals do enough in the way of educating those who make those decisions. And then you look at what's happening now, like recently with the Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut. You know, now mental health is coming to the forefront in terms of addressing it, but they're only looking at it as, well, if a person's got a mental health issue, then don't sell them a gun. But they're not looking at the root causes that even put that person in that kind of mindset in the first place.
Yeah, because clearly that's once a person is in crisis. But the other thing they're not doing is thinking about mental health creatively, and this is a big problem we have. And this is a problem this is one of the challenges I'm bringing that I want to sort of challenge the mental health community on is, you know, it's a community based on theoretical orientations, on theories, and it's a soft science, but it's based on a certain structure, you know, of how things are done. And when you are going into certain homes and neighborhoods, that structure may not fit. The thing I can best compare it to is standardized testing. You know, the reason is the ACT is because the SAT was standardized on a certain population, which gave other populations a disadvantage. So, for instance, I would challenge a school that wanted to do away with, I think every school needs a school counselor. And I'm going to tell you, that's coming out clear and clear every day. Every school needs a licensed and experienced therapist on staff because there's grief and there's loss and there's, you know, my friend moved away.
And let's be clear, not guidance counselor. I mean, guidance counselor.
No, not guidance counselor.
But not someone who's dealing with testing and college preparation. You're talking about a licensed therapist who's there to deal with some of those stresses that those young people may be facing.
That the teachers, so that way a teacher does have someone there if they feel like that's out of their scope and they shouldn't venture into that territory. They have someone there that they can refer the child to that can appropriately address what's going on and if need be refer the child to additional services. But if you're going to do it with, you know, the rest of it, then you have to say, I'm getting rid of this because it doesn't work for this population, but I'm adding this. So maybe it is an individual that will work at your school. Maybe it's group that will work at your school. Can you find someone that can lead groups, can lead, you know, a freshman group and a sophomore group where these kids can come and do a lot of peer intervention? But there needs to be some component, and you have to get creative about what that component looks like. For me, like I said, I've used writing. So I'll create a writing group. You don't want to sit and talk to a therapist about your feelings? Fine. Well, your peers are going to become your little therapist, and your peers are going to critique you on your writing, and they're going to give you feedback, and they're going to tell you how you make them feel, and they're going to encourage you, and we're all going to be responsible for you here, you know? it doesn't have to come in a cookie cutter way, but there needs to be something that addresses it on every campus.
Mm. Yes.
And
yes.
So that's
listen.
Where I think mental health could do better. We need to challenge ourselves to be more creative in our approaches.
You know, I think you're right. And then also be able to present that to those who are not in that, you know, who are not mental health professionals, so that they can understand it and see the value in it. I mean, if we're using data right now to evaluate everything, you know, in terms of its effectiveness, I think that there needs to be a data-driven piece that shows results so that people can see the tangibles and understand the value of what's happening. I mean, as a school administrator, I'm thankful that I was a guidance counselor first. So I had a different lens than many of those who I worked with because I came out of the ranks of counseling and I understood the value of what counselors do.
Yeah.
We're going to take another commercial break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about today's young people and, you know, does the phobia still exist with this next generation of young people who seem to be more transparent in terms of their privacy. So we'll be right back after this quick commercial break.
Okay.
We must be having some technical difficulty today. Are you still there with me, dear?
I'm here.
Okay, so we're going to continue because I don't know what's going on with the commercials. But anyway, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is this new world where young people are more transparent than their parents. You know, is it as a therapist? You know, they post their feelings up on Facebook. Sometimes they post pictures and things that are inappropriate.
Too much.
And share stuff. I mean, now you're working with this new group. Well, I don't even want to say new group, but we do realize that things that I would say that I would never put out publicly, I see it done on a regular basis without a care.
Yeah, it's too much.
The question I have is: is that helpful now? In terms of getting them to talk about their feelings, are they more open or are they only transparent when it comes to certain things?
Okay, well, I think they're two different things because, say, Facebook and Twitter and texting is a way of exposing your feelings without necessarily being directly connected. So you can express it, but you don't really have a direct connection to who you're expressing it to. And the danger of that they don't realize is that, you know, these intimate thoughts and feelings are things that not everybody in the world are going to use to help you. A lot of people in the world will use them to prey on you or to hurt you in some capacity. And, they, you know, for them, that's just them keeping it real. But it's still a bit of cowardice because you're hiding behind your Facebook page. You're not directly confronting or talking to someone. You're not, you're not confident in what you're saying enough to say it to them verbally. So there's a little bit of a third wall provided by those types of outlets. But I will say in sessions, I find when I do assessments, I go and I meet the family and I meet the kid, meet the parents. And so I talk to the parents and the parents give me the list of, you know, what's wrong and what their concerns are and where they think it started and some history. And then I'll meet with the kid separate. And that's always just funny because it's just two very different versions of what's happening or things that the parent says is not happening. The kid's like, oh, that's happening all the time. And so you can the parents are still in that mindset of we don't know this person. We just want to – I just want her to know certain things. And the kid is basically like, I think it's so hypocritical that the parent's not telling you everything. I'm going to tell you everything. So the kids are a lot more open in session, and it's a lot easier to build their trust and their rapport a lot of times than it can be the parents. There are exceptions to every rule, but for the most part, the kids are a lot more trusting. And so they end up progressing therapeutically beyond their parents. And so at that point, I have to sort of teach them coping skills because their parents have lived with whatever they're dealing with a lot longer and found ways to cope with it and not deal with it. And so they may not want to give up that coping. They may feel like, I'm doing just fine with it. Whereas the kid is still young enough to feel like, well, I don't want to do it that way. I want to deal with it all, you know. And so they're a little bit more, they haven't had as many bumps in the road or they haven't been as damaged yet. They haven't been as bruised up as some of us have as adults. So they're still willing to take the risk. And so that's always really interesting. And getting them to understand that your parent is a human being and they've been through things and they may not be ready to do what you're doing, but you can still do it.
Yes. That's a great observation. I think the older we become, I think it becomes harder and harder to kind of dig deep into those painful experiences that we've had and to actually openly talk about it. And of course, as a parent, you're always trying to weigh being, I guess the example for your child or the strength, you know, and then be able to show that vulnerability. It's a very scary thing for a parent. I would use the same analogy for a teacher who's used to teaching teacher-directed lessons. You know, I'm in control. I have the power. And then when you say, well, no, you got to, you know, incorporate the students and let them take some ownership in their work and deal with student outcomes, giving up that power or that perception of power can be a very scary thing.
Yes, and also I think probably similar too is every relationship is a mirror, is a reflection of something in ourselves that we need to look at either positively or we need to work on. And so what happens a lot is 9 times out of 10, the parent has the most difficulty with is the kid that reminds them the most of themselves. I mean, you stand back and watch it. It's like watching them fight with a younger version of themselves. It's very interesting to watch. And I think a similar thing has to happen with teachers where they look and say, what is this kid trying to teach me? Because clearly this challenging kid is here to teach me something that's going to make me grow as a teacher. What is this kid here to teach me? And that's kind of what a similarity between parents and their children is. When you see this in your child, this child is living out your own unresolved issue. You know, this child is replaying something for you that you didn't deal with, but you lived through and you coped through, but you didn't deal with. And so now they're bringing it up, you know, 30 years later, you don't want to deal with it. But it's here. It's here in a flesh and blood form. And that is, I have to do the same thing when I have a challenging client. Like, oh, my God, this kid must be here to teach me something because I'm going to be a better therapist after this kid. If I can figure this kid out, I'm going to be a better therapist. And that's what teachers have to say. Teachers have to say,
Yes. This
kid is a challenge because they're here to help me grow as a teacher. And there's something here this kid is trying to show me about an underdeveloped part of myself as a teacher. And if they look at it through that lens, I'm telling you, it will probably end up being their favorite student once they're done. That kid will be their favorite kid. But it's just all in how they look at it.
Wow. Let me ask you this question. I'm going to throw a word out at you, and I want you to give me your opinion on this term. Hyperactivity. You've heard the term ADHD.
Yes. I'm laughing because I'm being sarcastic,
but what is that?
I'm laughing because your friend Mark found an article on this yesterday, and we just had a big discussion about it yesterday. And, I mean, that diagnosis is a tricky one. And I say that because it's gotten kind of wrapped up into the system of things, you know. It's gotten, I think, away from its original clinical intent and gotten caught up in this system of how to deal with certain types of kids. And I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg, or, you know, when we were discussing yesterday, we were talking about there's so many facets to the issue of diagnosing ADHD. There's a lot of parents who are pushing that, saying they want the kid diagnosed with that and given medication. There are teachers who ask for it. There are psychiatrists who will sign for it. And so it definitely is a diagnosis that needs a more in-depth evaluation. Typically,
I'm sarcastic about that particular term. And I think you touched on it in terms of it being wrapped up into the system of things. But I got to tell you, if this term was present when I was in elementary school, then I would have been diagnosed.
ADHD.
Then.
Oh, yeah.
So
many people would have.
And I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you the reason why is because there's a lot of the lessons that I was being exposed to were outright boring.
Yeah.
And non-engaging. And so my mind wandered, and I started to focus on other things. And I never forget one day this teacher called my father and brought him to school and said, "Hey, your son cheated on this test." And he said, "Well, what makes you say that?" She said, "Well, when everybody else was taking a test, he was reading a comic book." And so she said, "And he passed the test, and it's not possible."
Okay.
And so he
right.
said, So I said, I took the test. I said, and I put it down, and I started doing something else. She said, you didn't answer those questions. You got that from somebody. She said, "Well, what's the answer to this? What's the answer to that?" And I answered each answer correctly, but I was bored, and so I would play with
yeah.
my friends or mess with someone else, and or just get into something else because my curious mind would take me other places. And I think sometimes, you know, it's an excuse for lessons that don't really actively grab these creative minds. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I would say since I started with mental health, I've only walked in on one case where I was like, this is face-to-face ADHD. You know, like this is it. This is what it would look like. I can just speak from my perspective. For me, there's a lot of things I have to rule out. A lot of things I have to rule out before I'm convinced of an ADHD diagnosis. Because difficulty with folk, you know, there's different types of ADHD. There's inattention and there's hyperactivity. So
yeah.
inattention is the one I think that usually gets really the most probably misdiagnosed. So inattention could be because of depression. It could be because of anxiety. It could be because of stress. It could be because of grief and loss and bereavement. It could be a learning disability that's undiagnosed. It could be so many different things. It could be the kid doesn't have glasses, so they don't understand what's going on the board. It could be the kid has an auditory issue that's undiagnosed. So I do a big screening on kids who... And I don't, even if they come in with that diagnosis, I'm hesitant to send them to the psychiatrist until I've done a really thorough rule out. Now, that's my approach to it. There is, right now, though, again, and this ties very closely into education, because when you have a failing school system or when you have an educational system that is not sustainable or not set up to meet needs, and not
mm-hmm.
set up for different personality types. It's set up is for cookie-cutter personality types. You're always going to have your deviants. You're always going to have your ones that don't fall within the lines. And there's nothing set up for what to do for those kids or how to engage those kids. My oldest daughter is very physical.
Who quite often are very, very bright.
Very bright. My oldest daughter is, you know, what she's one of those kids who they pay the most attention when they're doing something else. So, you know, if I really want her to pay attention to something I'll say, here, draw and listen, because she can do both better than if she just sits and listens. That's harder for her because she's physical. She would probably be, somebody would have considered her hyperactive. But she's actually a very kinesthetic learner. She's very into doing and engaging, and which a lot of children are. The system's not set up for that. So when these kids don't fit into this cookie-cutter model, they become deviants, and they're looking for quick solutions to deal with the problem. And so they put them in this box of ADHD. When you actually see ADHD, you know you're looking at ADHD. It is an inability. They have so much difficulty with sitting still. It's not about whether they're interested in the subject or not. They could be very interested in the subject, but they just have really difficult times with impulse and with managing that energy. So that is something that is real. You know what it kind of reminds me of? Bipolar. Everybody says bipolar, yeah. Bipolar. And nobody really knows what bipolar is anymore. You barely even would recognize a textbook case of bipolar because people use it so haphazardly. And I think that's what's happened with ADHD. It's not always, though, I will say, just the bright kid that's bored. It's also the kid with the learning disability, the kid who never got glasses, the kid whose grandpa just died and he didn't say anything about it, the kid whose mom and dad are fighting at home over finances in front of him. All these kids are stressed in different ways. And when you're stressed as an adult, what happens? You can't focus. You forget to do things. You lose your keys. You can't pay attention. You know, you have difficulty sleeping. These are all the same symptoms. So you really have to look very closely at it, and you have to be able to be willing to go through the entire spectrum of what it could be before you come to that type of conclusion.
And speaking of stress, there's a term, post-latency traumatic stress disorder. It's basically taking the effects of slavery on black people, years of Jim Crow, police brutality, and things of this nature, and it's saying that we suffer from a stress disorder based upon our historical journey here in America. Now, do you see the effects of our history, whether it be the slave experience, Jim Crowism, police brutality? Do you see that the effects of that on the young people that you work with?
I see it a lot on their parents. You don't see it as much on the children themselves, but you see it a lot in their parents, and so the danger there is that they're going to show the effects of it if the parents continue to instill the effects of it. So
do you think it's something that can be passed down, like generational,
It's definitely like that. I'll give you a textbook example is, and this is kind of something that's been recently different. I had a conversation with Mark again, and I said, I can't fathom as a black woman not working, not having a source of income, and I have kids. Even if I'm married and I was married to a wealthy person, I would still feel like something could happen at any time, and I would need to hold it down. Like the thought of just being able to sit home and not have access to some way to keep us afloat is terrifying for me. But, of course, when you look at post-traumatic stress disorder coming from slavery, the strategy of killing the man in front of the pregnant woman, moving into Jim Crow, moving into the welfare system of your man can't be in the house, you're either going to feed your kid or your man got to get out. Which one is it going to be, your man or your kids? These are all things that directly affected how our families are structured today. Black men and women are still fighting over who's going to be the head of the household because black women feel like you may not be here.
Yeah.
There's a good chance you may not come home for whatever reason. And if you don't, I need to be able to hold it down. And how do I relinquish that back to you and feel safe?
Hold that thought. We have a caller. Caller, could you please let us know your name and what is your question?
Yes, Brother Shango. It's Brother Forrest Muhammad, brother. I'm sorry. I did ring the bell, but I wanted Sister to finish her thought. I thought it would coincide with her finishing her thought. I apologize for interrupting her thought. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Well, please, go ahead with your question or your comment.
See, brother, I come from a long line of teachers, maybe from from slavery. My great-grandmother taught my grandmother. My great-grandmother was a slave. My grandmother was a teacher for 50 years. My cousins, my aunts, all teachers. So I grew up in a teacher's environment. I used to teach kindergarten myself. Teaching where I grew up and watched it was a calling. It's not a job. It's not really a profession. It's beyond a profession. Probably why most of the greater teachers are women, because it takes a certain nurturing capability to nurture children, especially Black and Latino children who come from a family wound hurt. If you ever listen to one of our other shows, JoJo Pa comes on the show with Sister Aisha Grifa Smart on Creatively Speaking and talks about the family hurt. We pass on from generation to generation all the hurt that's happened to us since our sojourn in America. And trust me, if you don't believe it, what Sister was saying is very true. My wife is the same way. I say, honey, stay at home. You don't need to work. I got it. She got to work. She's like, hey,
yeah.
You got to work. I got to work. I got to have my own. I'm like, well, your bank account's kind of full. No, I got to have my own. But I want to get back to the teaching part, because I remember one year I volunteered and taught a group of 4- and 5-year-olds. I was working for a Fortune 500 company. They moved. I decided not to move. They gave me 2 years severance pay. So I took a year off and just kind of found myself. And I found myself volunteering at a school called Timbuktu Academy in Trenton, New Jersey. And I did that for a year. And I taught these children math, computer science, and I took them to the local community college one day. And my 4- and 5-year-old children, boys and girls, got on the computers, turned them on, logged in, and began to work. And the white people looked like they were at the zoo. And it goes back to what Brother Shango said. Children seek the level you give them.
So
a lot of our teachers, even though they're Black, they have a white mind. They believe that their own Black children. See, I come from the opposite of the spectrum. I come from, baby, you Black, but you got to do it 10 times better.
Uh-huh.
All the teachers taught us that. You have to do it 10 times better. You're already good, but you got to be better. So you had a whole, when segregation killed us, desegregation. When we were segregated and we had our own Black teachers, Black principals, Black school boards, we were better educated. That's why I'll say any day of the week, you give me a third grade educated person born prior to 1950 from South Carolina, North Carolina, wherever there was segregation, they went to all Black school systems. They're better prepared and better thinkers than those who have been trained out of college. It goes back to what Malcolm X said. You can tell the difference between an educated dog and a trained dog. A trained dog, you kill the bird, it goes and gets the bird, doesn't take a bite out of it, brings it right back to you. An educated dog takes the bird, eats it, and you'll never see him again. This is the problem. Our children are educated already. They already know that this system is failing. They just can't articulate it. So, like you said, Brother Chung, when you were in school, you were kind of bored because they teach you George Washington and standardized teaching. Spot Run, Team Jake Run, and it goes back to Chaos One. Say run spot over with a damn steamroller. It goes back to our whole mentality. That the reason why our children are failing in school is because school is failing them. They're not failing. School is failing them. The teachers, and I've sat down with a lot of Black teachers when my children were going to school, and brother, if you're not from New York, Brother Sean can bear witness. My daughter, my oldest daughter went to Bronx Science. She's at University of Rochester on a full scholarship. My son goes to Brooklyn Tech, and my youngest daughter goes to Columbia Secondary School, which is used to be Columbia Day School, which is affiliated with Columbia University. Well, how did that happen? Well, because, one, my grandmother told me, marry a smart woman. If you marry a dumb woman, you have dumb children. So that's the first thing I did. I married my calculus tutor from college. So I looked at that.
You made a wise decision, brother.
but again, I married a woman who was nurturing educator, because that's who she was. My educator, she was my peer educator, but she was an educator, so she hasn't stopped being what she was from the womb. That's why my children are number one math and science, because that's what my wife is. And I'm not dumb myself by no stretch of imagination, but again, it takes a partnership. But then when we go into school, Another thing, we went to school, we didn't start having children until we turned age 30. A lot of times, especially when I go with my youngest daughter, who's 12 years old, they go, is that your grandfather or your great-grandfather? That's my dad. You know, so there's a lot of dynamics going on, sister, and I'm telling you, I'm loving the show. This show is so right on point. The points are made, but I just wanted to come in because a lot of people want to be teachers because it's a paycheck, and to be honest, it's one of the worst paychecks you can get right now, so you're not getting the cream of the crop like you used to.
Right.
When my grandmother was teaching and my great aunts were teaching, so teachers were respected, number one. Number two, they were paid on a scale balance. They were paid pretty well. They wasn't poor. They wasn't rich. Now you're getting teachers coming in. They're getting the baseline salary. Who pays $100,000, $200,000 to go to private school, going to $200,000 worth of debt to get a job paying $25,000, $27,000, $30,000 to start? Nobody. Not anybody intelligent. So we have to change the pay scale so we can get the best and the brightest to teach the future. You can't have dummies trying to bring the best and the brightest forward. That's the problem. You got a bunch of almost made it through college people, history majors, can't teach math, can't teach biology, can't put together a lesson plan, don't have any creativity because all they did in college was smoke dope and come on. I mean, I can tell you because I went to school.
Well, I think part of what you're saying is like that it's not, it's about what we value. It's about the value system. I remember when I went to Seattle that I was shocked because, you know, somebody they informed me, a friend who lived there told me that artists and teachers and social workers, they get like a rent decrease because as a society, as a neighborhood, as a community, they wanted these people to know that they were valued in their society and that they wanted them there. And, you know, like you were just saying, teaching stopped being treated as a noble profession, but also it started being standardized on a particular group once, you know, things were desegregated. It was standardized still by the same group as opposed to saying, okay, we have different groups with different cultures and we create different avenues of learning to accommodate these different cultures. It was like, no, everybody's going to have to meet this standard of this group. And that is where we've struggled ever since. Because that group is getting smaller.
Let me just say, not only, Brother Suarez, do we have to raise the standard of pay, we have to raise the standard of education because many of those who are coming out of, who are your teaching class now, are products of a substandard education. So they can only pass along what has been presented to them. And on that note, I'm going to have to cut you off because you're going to cut me off in a couple of minutes because my show's coming to a close.
Ownership has its privilege, but I just got to add one more point, Brother Sherman. You opened the door, brother, but I want to ask you this question because you are the master educator on the Black Hope Radio Network, brother. You are that. We reference you all the time throughout all our shows. And this is one point I want to make, brother. How did we come out of slavery? 11 years later, we had universities, colleges, towns, our own financial system out of slavery. How did that happen? And now we have masters, PhDs, and above, but we can't get out of the ghetto. So I'm going to leave it like that. That's my last thing. Thank you all for letting
me. Is that a question or a statement?
It could be either one, brother. It depends on how you get it.
Okay. Well, listen, you know, I think the one thing that I've always heard is the term educated fool. And I think it ties into something that Brother Forrest said earlier that education was a horror, and we came out of schools, one-room schoolhouses. My mother was in a one-room schoolhouse, but the motivation to strive for academic excellence and to tie education to the connection of, you know, not you becoming educated as an individual, but that your education is connected to the development of your community, that message has been lost. And in losing that message, you have an educated class that wants to be more accepted by mainstream society, regardless of leaving behind their own people And there's a saying that I often hear Minister Louis Farrakhan say is that no man can rise above the condition of his people. So here we are producing more doctors and lawyers and engineers, but we have no housing, we have worse health, we have worse living conditions, even though we're supposed to have all of these professions that are supposed to impact us in a positive way. And I think that the problem is that education is not connected to a greater mission. But I want to shift gears because we don't have a lot of time, and I want to get into the spoken word. Now, sister, you promised me if you were going to give us a spoken word, or anything, a hip-hop piece, a poetry piece, and let's be clear, we really didn't spend time dealing with how you use spoken word to in your practice and working with young people and educating teachers. So if you can give us a little piece about how you do that and then hit us with one of your powerful pieces, we listening and we waiting.
Okay, so like I talked about expanding what therapy looks like and creatively using art to sort of bridge the gap between people who have difficulty accepting mental health but still need the effects of mental health, who need the benefits of mental health. One of the things I do is I do use a lot of hip-hop and poetry in my sessions with clients, and I love it. In fact, it was interesting. I was having a conversation with another a program director that I was working with to create a show called Dirty Laundry at Cal State LA recently, and she asked the question, like, how do we get mental health, how do we get therapy to Black people without them knowing that it's mental health or therapy? And then we put together this workshop where we worked with, you know, Black and Latino students on their writing, and then they did a performance, and everybody left there feeling really inspired and uplifted. And then we looked at each other and said, that's how you do it. That's how you get therapy to Black people without them knowing that it's therapy to people of color. And so I think being creative, being artistic, being musical, being these very, you know, theatrical and writing and creatively oriented people, that's just always been a means of expression. It's very natural for people of color. And so one of the things I'm working on right now is soul sessions, where, you know, taking like that 21st century school model of using technology, Skyping with students, introducing them to spoken word, introducing them to that as a form of expression, and clarity and being clear on what they feel and what they want to express, but without sort of with a lower cost for schools because they're having trouble with budget crisis, than bringing me out there would cost, you know? So I get to have these great, and it actually gives me more energy and more time to spend with the students because I don't have to travel. I can do it via Skype or some other form of live stream. And it's been amazing. I had one with 200 seventh graders in Jessup, Georgia. And I was trembling when we finished because I was so overjoyed. It was so amazing to have that kind of connection. And the teacher wrote me and the students sent me a book and they all signed it and everybody was just felt in a good place. And the only thing I regretted was, how do we keep that going? You know, how can I reach these kids monthly? You know, how can I work with them and their teacher and kind of co-create with their teacher this atmosphere where their minds are more open, not just to the basics, because you're going to get the basics. If you start with creative thinking and critical thinking, you're going to get the basics. One of my kids' teachers told me, I worry about the kids that seem the most advanced because they struggle with what to do when they don't get the answer. They struggle with critical thinking. They're so used to just getting it that if you ask them, why did you come to that conclusion, they get stuck. And I think it's so important to introduce creative writing and critical thinking to students and then create that atmosphere. So that's kind of what my goal is in the next school year, is to partner with as many schools as possible to create this like co-relationship with the teacher where I can Skype in with the students monthly and help to facilitate creating this atmosphere with students and the teacher through creative writing. I'm very excited about it. So it's something I'm really putting a lot of energy into right now, and I pray really, really takes off. So with that being said, the piece that seems most appropriate is called Purple Files, and I'm not a big introduction person, so I'll just go ahead and start the piece. As we lay in green pastures and rest beside the still waters, we fail to see that this cup is running over. Fail to see the water rising past ankles or knees, or to hear the desperate screams of the drowning. It is far more comforting for all of us to believe that they are just all hydrophobic. Society's response to their cries is to create systems, be it foster, educational, or prison, cleverly disguised as helping hands reaching out to muddy water populations, offering salvation while all the while refusing to get dirty, flirting with the illusion of unity while systematically avoiding issues plaguing low-income communities. See, I see the disparity. Watch purple files grow from infancy to teens, change to Manila, trade in their lives for orange jumpsuits to army green. It seems the people have been misled to believe that these institutions were placed here for our benefit. The general public won't question it. Most believe the youth to be voiceless because they choose to suffer in silence. Others will act out in violence, while still there will be the few who choose to use the pen to forge their rebellion. Battalions of ballerinas and musicians who live by a creed that crescendos off the walls of should-be empty group homes, then trickles down tear-stained windows. See, they know they are a force to be reckoned with, a power to be recognized, as raw as an undisturbed diamond and as valuable as undiscovered oil beneath the earth's surface. All three have monumental purpose when placed into the right hands, but far too often they are not. Forced onto city blocks to be educated in the school of hard knocks, but not all of our children fall victim to the system. Picasso still paints pictures using 14-year-old fingertips and spray cans, writing in black letters and languages few can understand. See, they can still feel color in their veins. It's a shame most of us are too grown to appreciate, too stoned to see the poetry in your average 15-year-old MC's hip-hop lyrics, too afraid to crack open his metaphors, see the pain in his pores and deal with it. Mistake Jesse Owens for a hoodlum, hopping ghetto fences as though the next step is the only thing that matters. Evidence that this illusion can all be shattered. Living artifacts of the art, in fact, they memorialize our ancestors with their passion. Turn dreams into action with few stars to wish upon, only the prayer that some still exist beyond the smog and the gun smoke. Provoked often, learning their crafts in the most distracting of environments. Staying focused on hard work and mom's early retirement, and we forget to remind them of their value. Lose their compliments amidst our disdain for their peers, yet and still they raise themselves throughout those pivotal years. God bless the child who wipes away his own tears, who tap dances to music that only his ears can hear, practices plies, leaps, and backflips without fear, who strives for the gold even when nobody shows up to cheer. Here's to you, the youth whose truth gets buried beneath media stereotypes, funded by federal dollars, raised by blue collars that you will never have to wear. I swear, our children are not lost. Our futures are still here.
Wow, I wish I had a clap track or something. So, you know, I know I'm supposed to snap my fingers, but all I can say is, that was a powerful poem, sister, and what a wonderful to end this show. I wish I had more time to talk. People were coming to an end. I want to thank you so much for being our guest, and I hope I can get you to come back, because I really want to do part two on the poetry piece, which we didn't get a chance to get into.
Definitely.
I want to remind our audience that the purpose of Truth School is to solve problems. We want to thank our special guest, Ms. Thea Monet. We'd like to thank you, the audience, and, of course, our producer, Brother Forrest and Brother Jason. Next up, we have Community Awareness, Disaster Preparedness with Rudolph Muhammad. Very powerful show. Tune into him because he's always giving us practical approaches to dealing with crisis. Thank you again. This is Shungo Blake, and this has been another segment of True School Show.
Now, boss. now, boy. I remember when radio used to be just like this. You turn on the radio and you actually get something for your money worth, even though it's free. You had to pay for no satellite radio back then. You had good, solid radio for your brain, something that make you think. I remember. Now that's that black hole radio, or Blog Talk Radio.